Welcome to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. I hope it's nice where you are. Spring's coming.
Yeah, you keep saying that.
Yeah, I know. Well, Ron used to say that, you know, he was a farmer. He used to say that all the time.
Well, of course, we're recording this mid-April, and for a lot of people, winter is coming because the new season of Game of Thrones starts this weekend. And that's the big thing in Game of Thrones. Winter is coming.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, Mom, why don't you let our listeners know who we will be speaking with today, or whom,
okay.
Whom we will be speaking with.
Today we're speaking to the author of Too Much of Not Enough. It's a memoir. And Jane Pollock is the author. She was born in the heart of the Midwest in Columbus, Ohio, but she inherited the city gene from her New York City native parents. When she was five, they returned the family to a neighboring suburb, White Plains, where she grew up. She graduated from Mount Holyoke College, and a BA in Studio Art and Theater, and an MA in Art Education from Columbia University Teachers College. So, this book is, like I said, a memoir and extremely interesting.
Welcome to Writer's Voices, Jane.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
And are you in Manhattan today?
I am in Manhattan in my wonderful apartment. I'm so happy I'm here.
So, getting to Manhattan was kind of a long journey for you. And that's
it was
pretty much what this book is about, isn't it?
You know, it is. It's, you know, I had a vision. I had gone to teachers college here in 1970-71, and I loved it, but I thought you either have to be a student, very rich or very poor, you know, to live in Manhattan. And I never was any of those things. But when I was separating and getting divorced, I used to come in all the time. I lived only an hour away in Connecticut. And a friend and I were at theater together, and she had moved from a neighboring town to New York City. And she said, "What's keeping you in Connecticut?" And it was the quintessential question, because my work was virtual, my marriage was over, my children were grown, and there was nothing keeping me in Connecticut. It was just an epiphany. It's like, oh my gosh, now I can go to New York, which I've always wanted to. And the pieces fell into place very quickly and very easily for me.
And in fact,
I've never looked back. I'm so happy here.
In fact, your children were in New York also, weren't they?
It's funny. They all three were in New York. Two were married, and then they slowly moved away. My younger daughter moved to California almost right away. My son had a baby and moved to a neighboring town in Westchester, Rye, New York. And my daughter is still there, but she helped me look for apartments. And we found my apartment on the very first day. It took me longer to find. Now I own my own apartment, but for the first 3 years I rented not too far from her. And that was really a pleasure, you know, and New York can be so daunting and not welcoming, but she, you know, we got in with a realtor. There's something called Street Easy. We saw five or six buildings, and when we got to the one where I eventually moved, it was like, this is it, you know. It was so clear. They had a space and I moved. It was, you know, from conception to my reality, it was 18 months, and things don't really happen like that, you know, most of the time. It's pretty remarkable.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Your memoir is really kind of, to put it into sort of perspective, you're a woman who lived a very traditional life, growing up in the 50s and 60s, coming of age, but following a very traditional, you know, get married, have children, learn to teach as a backup plan. I've had a conversation recently where we're talking about women my age, and I'm just a little bit younger than you are. And where, when we were growing up, we had like three career options open to us.
Yes.
other than being a housewife. You could be a secretary, a nurse, or a teacher.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
And you were more or less happy in that life, but then the bomb dropped and it all exploded. And your memoir is really about the second act being better.
so much better. You know, I really came, I came to, it's like they say, you're swimming in the water, you don't even realize that it's the water you're swimming in. And I didn't know how unhappy, I hate to say that because I have kids, you know, and I adore my kids and I love being a mother, but I was not happy in my marriage. And now that I've been out of it for 7-8 years, and also had a wonderful 6.5 year love relationship, you know, I realized how much I endured. And the reason I endured it was because my household, it was identical to my household. And I couldn't see that because it doesn't look like this, but it felt like that. I replicated that feeling of not enough. You know, I went from a household where I was not enough to a marriage where I was not enough. And that, of course, I say that it's self-imposed. And then, you know, what I talk about in the memoir in Too Much of Not Enough is how I came to value myself so much that I could, you know, I could be resilient and bounce back after the marriage collapsed because, he didn't want me to change. He loved the traditional housewife when I wasn't really housewife, I did teach and I raised kids and I always had a side business, a side hustle, as they call it now. Mm-hmm. I was always making some money. But my kids, I was fascinated by the whole, learning of childcare. And also what I realized is as I was raising kids, what I had missed as, you know, in my own childhood, the nurturing I didn't get. So I was reparenting myself through other mothers who I was meeting who were also full-time moms. So it all needed to be, but I didn't know it at the time. I just knew that was the path that I was on.
Mm-hmm.
You write about learning from Lamaze and from La Leche League, which is for breastfeeding mothers. And I, you know, most of the things that you wrote, I did the same things.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. Yeah, yeah.
And
well, I mean, I had never had those frank discussions with women ever. You know, talking about our bodies and that we were allowed to touch our own bodies. No. And I was shocked when this woman said, you know, I, you know, felt inside and there was a little lump and my doctor said, what were you doing with your hands in there? And I was thinking, yeah, what were you doing with your hands in there? And then I read Our Bodies Ourselves and it's like, oh, it's my body. It's my body. You know, and that was mm-hmm. not something we were taught as children. You know, if you're almost my vintage, you know, doctors were revered. They had the answers and you didn't ask the questions or they'd say, oh, where did you go to medical school? I mean, it was just very rote in those days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Mom, you have some stories about standing up to doctors, don't you?
Yeah, but I didn't for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, but yeah, there were a couple of times you were the product of one of them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You want to talk about that, Monica?
I don't know, Mom. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, I had my gallbladder removed, and I was pregnant with Monica, but I had to have my gallbladder out because I was having attacks constantly. And so when I have muscle spasms, and I still have them in my body, and I was having them. And so these interns in the middle of the night came in, and they said, well, we probably should do some more x-rays to make sure you're not in labor. And I said, no more x-rays. That was the first time.
It's memorable. It's memorable when you speak up. And the thing we were told by the Lamaze instructor, you know, you don't want silver nitrate in your child's eyes because that, you know, mm-hmm. they could go, if there's a possibility of syphilis, I think it was. And I thought, well, there's no possibility, you know, of that. I know. And, you know, I said to my husband, just in case, you know, don't you think she doesn't need it? He goes, well, just let her have it anyhow. And so I was intimidated, not that I suspected him of anything, and I don't think there was anything. But hey, you know, I was, you know, you're lying on the delivery table, and, you know, I didn't have the advocate saying, we don't want it. We want her to be able to see me, you know, after she's born and not be blinded for with this silver nitrate stuff. So, you know, we were well instructed, and I did, you know, I did ask for a few things, but I was very intimidated. It was all changing. And now I wouldn't consider a doctor, you know, who wouldn't allow me to ask questions.
Do you know if they still do that for newborns routinely?
I believe they do.
Wow.
Really? Oh, well.
I believe they do. I think so.
Yeah. Now, Jane, this isn't your first published book. You have
no, written, it's actually my third.
Your third. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the earlier books.
Sure. My first book was Decorating Eggs, Exquisite Designs with Wax and Dye. I had a 30-year career as an egg decorator. And, you know, the reaction most people have, and all that, one of the portions I want to read is about that. You know, people's eyes would glaze over. They'd say, oh, that's nice, dear. But I will say that my eggs went from $8, you know, at the first exhibit I went to nearly $500 each by the time I closed my business in the early 2000s.
Wow.
They're museum quality, collected by Steve Jobs. They're in the Smithsonian, and I had four presidential eggs that I designed. So they weren't your cookie cutter, you know, little scene inside of an egg kind of thing. They were really small masterpieces. So the first one was about that and came out in 96 and did, sold over 30,000 copies. It did extremely well. And then I wrote a book called Sole Proprietor, S-O-U-L Proprietor, 101 Lessons from a Lifestyle Entrepreneur, because I made a business out of decorating eggs. And people wanted to know that story. And there were 101 different lessons I learned about being a home-based business. You know, my definition of a lifestyle entrepreneur is someone whose business works for them. They don't work for their business. It very much melded into my life. It grew as my kids grew. I could manage it, and it was very much out of my own interest and hands that it grew. And so there are a lot of people who have those kind of home-based businesses. And so I was a spokesperson for that. And that got a lot of mileage as well. So you can buy the audio version, the print version is out of print now. I think you can pick them up on eBay. But, you know, that stayed in print for 10 or 15 years. It was, you know, wonderful, wonderful stories. And I really, you know, I still stand by them.
Wow. So why did you stop the egg decorating?
Well, I had done it for 30 years, and as I like to say, I had said everything in eggs that I needed to say. And then also, you know how the universe starts throwing you, you know, it, like the finishes on the eggs. I used a two-part epoxy. It was a system, and it started crinkling instead of being smooth, and I didn't have the energy to research it. You know, I was just like, oh, this isn't working, and I don't care enough to find out. You know, for 30 years, I cared. And then a catalog had my eggs in them for the most expensive, $480 each. And they didn't sell well. And so I felt badly for the catalog and badly that I wasn't making the money from it. And then the ultimate was that I was supposed to be on the Martha Stewart show the week she went to jail.
Oh.
So I thought, okay. The signs are clear. At that point, I was doing a lot of professional speaking about how to turn your passion into a successful business. And I was being asked to coach, and the coaching was taking over. And I thought, I can't do two things really well, so I'm going to let go of the art. I did it for 30 years. I'm complete with it. And I'm going to focus on the coaching, and I've never looked back. That was about 2002. So sort of for 15 to 17 years now, I've been strictly coaching, speaking, and writing.
Okay, well, you accomplished what you wanted to do, and then you moved on, so that was good.
Exactly, yes.
So
thank you.
It seemed like it was easier for you to do that in your professional life than in your personal life.
Yes, it was. And I think I speak for a lot of women.
Yes.
That we work things out professionally that we can't work out personally. And one of the things I've learned in all the years of therapy and recovery work that I've done is that you can only go as far professionally as you have gone personally. So the things that I have trouble with personally, you know, I still get stuck on professionally. Mm. So, but I think because they're, you know, it's not a relative or, you know, that you're dealing with professionally, it's a little bit easier to set boundaries. But I still, you know, you can limit yourself if you aren't willing to tackle the things that hold you back.
Well, Jane, what made you decide at this point to tell your personal story?
You know, just like we opened the conversation about moving to New York, when I moved, and I've been blogging since 2008, I think, you know, I would blog about that and people say, that's my vision. You're so inspiring. And when I moved to New York, I actually fell in love with somebody. I met somebody through online dating a year and a half after I got divorced. And I had this wonderful 6-year relationship and people said, wow, I would like to do that. You're my role model for that. And then because things were a little bit slow when I moved into New York, I had some time on my calendar and I had money in my account. And I took advantage of something called Semester at Sea. And I went 25,000 miles around the world on a voyage with 500 students, 200 faculty and staff, and 65 lifelong learners. So, you know, again, I heard people saying, wow, how do you do that? How do you live what you want to live? And I thought, I love writing. I love writing about this. I think there's a story to tell. And so I took a course at a place called Kripalu. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's a yoga retreat center in Lenox, Mass. And I took a wonderful 5-day workshop with Ann Randolph, who's just a brilliant teacher. And it was a course called Taking Your Story to the Stage. And I started to write vignettes about my marriage and, you know, the collapse of my marriage and where I was, and got such positive responses as I would read them and share them. But I thought, I think there's something here. So that was 5 years ago. So it wasn't like I said, I'm going to write a memoir, and I sat down and wrote it. It really evolved from that and then forward. And, you know, really coming to what, and then I took memoir writing classes at Gotham Writers Workshop here in New York. And I thought, you know, what actually is my story? And as you noted, it was the after the marriage and reinventing myself in my second or third act, you know, depending on how long I live, you know, and telling that story, because I think, you know, the Pew research shows that baby boomers are getting divorced at an incredible rate, and people over 65 at a higher rate than ever before. And I believe I have something to say to those women particularly, but also to women in their 40s and 50s who are in marriages that aren't very happy, and think, well, you know, where am I going to go from here? And one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, being on the dance floor. You probably have had this experience at a wedding or something, and the band leader says, you know, anybody who's married less than 5 years, sit down. Less than 10 years, sit down. You know, and then there are just a few couples standing at 20, 25 years. And I wanted to be the last couple standing. I had devised that marriage was the ultimate goal in life, and I was going to stay married no matter what. And when that was taken away from me, you know, when it was no longer, I felt like I was free floating. I didn't know how to be. And I think a lot of women are sold a bill of goods that the only way you exist and show up in society is through marriage. So I wanted to disabuse people of that. It's, you know, I've never been happier or more fulfilled than since the marriage. And I did not want the marriage to end. I want to be very clear about that. I did not want it to end. And but then there was, you know, evidence that I couldn't look the other way any longer. And I thought, OK, then there must be another reason for me to be moving on. I didn't know what it was, and I had to live it out. And that's what I want. That's what I talk about.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. And our guest today is Jane Pollock, author of Too Much of Not Enough, a memoir.
Well, you have a lot of details about your childhood and in your early marriage, and I just wonder, how in the world do you remember all those things?
You know, some of them were seared into my memory. I have, I started probably journaling, you know, in the early 80s. So I was in my, you know, 30s and 40s. So there was a lot of things I kept track of. I'll speak for myself. When I was unhappy, a good place to record it. You know, I didn't have a best friend for a long time. I didn't have a place to bring that. And so I would write it down. And so I have a lot of written things. And then there are things that were just seared into my memory because they were so transformational. I'm not sure what the word is, you know,
life-changing.
But, yes. And, you know, defining moments as a child. I was such a shy kid. I know it's hard for some people to believe that, but I have a very extroverted, still have a very extroverted older sister. And so there wasn't a lot of room for me. So, you know, I was a goody-goody and shy and mommy's favorite and all that. And that paid off for a number of years. And I think, you know, what's interesting in a family system is that you still fall into those roles. So, you know, knock on wood, my siblings are all alive. And when we interact, I do fall into that, and I do see how I'm regarded. So, you know, some things don't change. So you're laughing.
Yeah,
know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
You have a scene where you're having dinner with your siblings and your parents, and how each of your siblings is, you know, acting out their role and so forth.
Yes.
And so, yeah.
Yes, it's the Bradshaw model. He called it the family mobile. And in every family, particularly dysfunctional families, he refers to, and it wasn't an alcoholic family, but my mother had mental illness, which was undiagnosed. But they said there's the lost child, the mascot, the hero, and the scapegoat. And I was absolutely the lost child, even though I thought I was the hero, you know, for a long time, because I got, you know, we all got good grades, but I thought, you know, I'm just quiet and perfect. And I realized, no, I'm the lost child. You know, my mother would say, you know, if I started to complain about something, she'd say, oh, not you, Jane, not you. You're like, you can't, you know, you can't be ill. You can't be, you can't, you know, need my attention. I've got to pay attention to the scapegoat over here. You know, she's the one who's driving me crazy and, you know, smoking in her room and going out with boys. So, you know, I was the lost child. And families, if you look at families, they fall into those categories.
So
pretty religiously.
Lost child, hero, scapegoat, and what was the fourth one?
Mascot. My sister was just adorable, and she would make make everybody laugh and dance, and, you know, look at me, I'm so cute, you know. So, or it could be the joke teller. My brother was an amazing joke teller in
okay.
the funny one.
Yeah.
But it distracts, you know, it distracts the parents from, you know, whatever the issues are that they don't want to look at.
Mm.
And there were many in our family.
Now, this is a good segue into a topic that usually comes up with memoirs, which is, how have your family members reacted to this?
You know, it's a really good question. And my siblings were among the first to read my first draft of it. None of them have read the final copy. And they, how shall I say, they didn't really dispute it. One sister said, I thought this was really funny. She said, we definitely played Ginny dolls in Meredith's room, not in our room. It was like she was adamant about that. You know, it's like, okay, if that's, you know, none of them disputed how difficult our mother was. That was not up for question. They did not dispute how unavailable emotionally my dad was. But sort of logistics, it's like it didn't happen that way. And memory, you know, there are books and essays on memory and how people remember. So, you know, what I say at the very beginning in my acknowledgments is, this is my memory. And, you know, they can write their own. I think it was Anne Lamott said, you know, and my siblings have not been unkind to me, but they, she said, you know, you knew I was a writer. You should have been nicer to me along the way. So I wouldn't write it. So, but my kids, they will not read it. You know, it's about a time in their lives that, you know, they have a certain mythology, and I'm not a mom who would say, oh, I want you to read my book. I understand. And I will not, you know, in any way force or even, you know, in no way demand that they read it. You know, at some point they may want to, but as you know, my ex-husband read it and thought it was fantastic. I wanted to quote him on the cover, you know, ex-husband thinks it's fantastic. He's an English teacher. And he was concerned about, you know, how I portrayed him. And he thought the only thing unfair was that he thought his memory of their early childhood, that he was more participatory than he was. And that's fine. You know, he's entitled to his memory. I saw it differently. But he said, you know, what child wants to read about their parents' sex life? Probably none. So I don't want to embarrass them. And, you know, I don't talk a lot about that because there wasn't a lot of it. So, but they may not want to know that either, you know,
right,
and
right.
they're free not to, you know, but at some point when we're dead and gone, they might say, so I wonder what it was like for mom. And, you know, I certainly didn't want to know much about my parents, but this caused me to want to know much more about them. And unfortunately, you know, we don't have all the digital records that we have now for, you know, what my parents were like as kids. So it's only what they told us and how it played out.
And your mother is no longer with us, I'm assuming.
Both of my parents are gone. My dad died in 93, my mother in 2005.
Yeah. And I'm actually kind of surprised that your ex-husband was so supportive.
Me too. Me too. Me too. Yeah. But he didn't, you know, he didn't deny any of it. He didn't deny any of it. But he was, you know, he's got his own stuff. And that's for him to, you know, if he ever chooses to write it. You know, what I say early in the book is that we went to couples counseling early, and the counselor said he wants to live in his own small box. And inside of his box is the Red Sox, Diet Coke, his English teaching, you know, students and papers, and baseball and literature. And anything outside of that, travel, theater, he did like movies. You know, he wasn't going to budge. And as long as I stayed in the box with him, he was really happy, really happy. And that was fun. But that box started to get very small, and it didn't really include a lot of things I was interested in. So the more I left the box, the less interested he became, and he found somebody who fit right into that box with him, and he's with her now, and that's God bless. You know, I think they're very happy.
You know, my story is somewhat similar. I like to say that when I was married for 19 years, and I married very young, and I say, well, I feel like I was living his life rather than mine. And my life now is completely different. And we're on very good terms. In fact, he works for one of my companies and that my son is running. And so, and he found somebody after we split up that wanted the same life as he
yeah.
did. And so they
yeah.
were a much better fit. You know, we were 18 and yeah. 20 when we got married. We were like 15 and 18 when we started dating.
I was
15. And so at that age, you really don't know what you want out of life. And
no.
it's challenging. I mean, sometimes people get together young and find that they want the same things. But I think mostly one or the other is going to have to be doing a huge amount of compromising. And
yes. And exactly what you're bringing up is why I wrote this, because what I want to do is free women up to tell their stories, to say, oh, you know, the same thing is happening for me. Either they're still there or they came out of it and they can see that there's, you know, so much potential afterwards.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I admit I was also very encouraged by the fact that you found love again. But it sounds like from the way you're talking about it, that relationship ended.
It did end. And I, for a variety of reasons, I would say he had an anger issue that didn't really come out early on, that became more evident as things were waning. Mm. And we never lived together. We lived 2 hours apart. And that was actually very nice. He loved me so much and was so good to me. And we had great sex. And that was, you know, that was something that was really missing in my marriage. And so where I am now is, I don't know that I want a, you know, too intimate relationship, but I would like to, you know, I said, it was funny, when I was dating before I met this man, I met several guys, and one said, you know, this woman just put so many boundaries around our relationship. She wanted to have dinner on Tuesday nights and a sleepover on Saturday night. And that was it. And I thought, I'm noting that down. That sounds really good to me. You know, like dinner in the middle of the week, you know, a little nooky, and then a sleepover on Sunday. Bye-bye, you know. And I thought, I'm going to borrow that, because my life is so full and so rich, and I have children and grandchildren. And, you know, I don't need to be defined by marriage anymore. I did for a very long time. And then also to know that I was loved, lovable, and sexual, because I didn't know any of that. And so, so I had all that, you know, 6 years of plenty. And now it's like, you know what? I don't need that to define me anymore. So I feel like I'm in a really nice place and, you know, widely available right now. Maybe in May that will change when this broadcast, but, you know, I'm putting it out there and I'm leaving, you know, the doors are wide open.
Mm. Yeah. I've been single now for 23 years. So I was married 19, single 23. And was in a relation. I had a couple of long-term relationships, but not in the last few years. And every now and then I think, oh, maybe I should try and find somebody. And then I think, no.
I'm a coach and I can just, you know, the energy in your voice is so low. Like, I don't think that's what you want.
No.
I don't think so.
Like
mom. I don't know when you'd have time, Monica.
I don't know when you'd have time. My life
it sounds like you're running a lot
so
of businesses
full.
And
yes.
Yeah.
And I travel a lot and I have kids mm-hmm. and I have grandkids and and I have very close men friends that I hang out mm-hmm. with. And so there's no lack. And so it's hard to figure out where I could fit somebody else in to that picture.
Tuesday night through Saturday. Sleepover.
Exactly.
You're free to borrow that. It's yours. It's yours. I give that away.
Well, Jane, why don't you read a little bit from Too Much of Not Enough?
I'd be delighted. I'd like to start at the beginning to set the tone and really what happened. And then I want to read a piece about my career and then about dating. So
great.
Here we go. And stop
All
me
right.
if I go too long.
No
so
problem.
Chapter one, After 37 years of marriage, Ben and I are meeting in a therapist's office in Wilton, Connecticut. My theme song throughout the marriage has been, "We Can Work It Out." But at this session in March 2010, Ben takes out a typewritten memo stating that another woman has become, in quotes, very important to him. The cliche of going cold with bad news is actually happening to me. I hear only silence. The sounds in my brain are a whoosh of nothingness and an inner dialogue. Did I just hear what I think I heard? Did he say he's in love with someone else? These thoughts are drowning out whatever ambient noise is actually around me. There's only a dull hum sending pulsing sensations between my ears. I'm aware of the texture of the couch I'm sitting on. The weave of the herringbone scratches my palm as I tug at a fuzzball that's nestled between the threads right next to my thigh. The diagonal lines of beige and brown intersect to form the pattern. I stare at these woolen marks and sink into their repetitiveness for what feels like an hour. I pull close my sweater, the gray buttonless cardigan we bought in San Francisco on a chilly August night so many years, summers ago, and I tuck my hands under my legs for additional warmth. Present again, I note that this statement by Ben signifies the end of my marriage because infidelity is a bottom line, non-negotiable. I'm also aware for the first time that another woman finds this man attractive. In our early coupledom, I tried to tell Ben how good-looking he was, the glory of his speckled gray-green eyes and the water moon curve of his sweet smile. But after years of his deflecting my compliments, I wish I were taller or I hate my hair, not to mention gravity's downward pull. This beholder could no longer see that original beauty. All I can think when I hear his words is, where did I go wrong? How did I miss this? Was there evidence I overlooked? I want to share something about, you know, what I thought love was. And, you know, you talked about being married early. So my first serious boyfriend was when I was 19 or 20. I was a sophomore and then junior in college. I should mention that I had had one serious boyfriend at Mount Holyoke starting at the end of my sophomore year. Matthew, a junior at Yale, was my first real love. We dated steadily through my junior year, his senior, slept in the same twin dorm bed, and fondled each other passionately, but never consummated our union. Matthew graduated that May and returned to his Chicago hometown to begin law school. Continuing to date would have been inconvenient for Mount Holyoke, so I selfishly broke up with him. Besides, I knew it would never work out because he was too different. During college, you saw a person only in their current milieu, surrounded by the choices of an institution. When I visited Matthew at his home during the first summer we were dating, I noticed startling differences in our upbringing. His Midwest house had Venetian blinds on the windows instead of draperies and area rugs on the wood floors rather than wall-to-wall carpeting. My vision was so narrow that something as foreign as alternate window treatments to change my opinion of someone I loved. The mercury in my romantic thermometer dipped below normal and never climbed back to the heat I had once experienced in his company. After finishing my degree at Columbia and having been to Ben's fully carpeted home in Fairlawn, I determined that this would be it. I loved him, thought he was funny and smart, and would make a good teacher. What else was there? Up until then, my life's milestones, other than my college major, had been decided for me. It was time to become a wife, and Ben fit the part. It surprised me that for a novice decision maker, I was unyielding. And then I wanted to share about my career. So we talked about the egg decorating. Friends who saw my earliest designs said I should enter them in a local craft show, the Pink Tent Festival in Stamford that summer. Their interest in me and my art was exciting and motivating. Craft shows in 1973 were a relatively new phenomenon. The one coming up on the large green near the Mill River was in its second or third year. Other than displaying and selling some of my pen and ink drawings in college, I had never put my artwork up for sale. But I went through the motions to apply, carrying a dozen of my eggs to show a jury member a few months before the event, being accepted, and then creating inventory, a booth, and a logo. I named my company An Egg by Jane and became a small business owner. Two things happened at that show in July that began the arc of a 30-plus year career. My booth consisted of a card table and tablecloth with my work displayed in a variety of holders. I priced each egg at $8. Strangers approached my booth, took out their wallets, and paid me money for my art. Not friends, not relatives, but complete strangers who weren't there to make me feel good, actually parted with their own hard-earned cash to purchase an object I had created. More surprisingly, an older woman with white hair and formal posture extended her hand to me, admired my work, and introduced herself as a special events director from Bloomingdale's. She asked if I'd be willing to conduct a Ukrainian Easter egg decorating workshop at the Stanford store the following spring. My first thought while packing up my booth after that show was, it's so easy to make money selling your art.
Said almost no one ever.
Right, exactly. But I was confident, you know, and it was like, you know, they call it, that's beginner's luck or uninformed optimism. So I have another one. Do we have time to read a couple more pages?
Yes, sure.
Okay, great. Okay. So after my marriage, I certainly mourned for a good 6 months. And then I thought, well, I'm just going to try this online dating thing. So this is about that. I'd been aware of online dating since the inception of Match.com in 1995. But had been relieved that it was not something I'd ever need to partake in. I'd watched my older daughter dabble in JDate, the Jewish matchmaking site, and how challenging it had been for her, although she did meet her husband that way. I couldn't imagine subjecting myself to that kind of scrutiny. Craft shows were hard enough, putting out all your goods for the public to walk by, handle, and choose to buy or not to buy. Now I would be the product up for grabs. Plus, at 62, I know I wasn't in a popular demographic. Most men my age preferred women in their 40s and 50s, I told myself. Lying about my age wasn't an option. At what point do you explain that to the person you've met, and how? I hoped that I would find someone who appreciated a woman who traveled the same decades as he had, who also needed afternoon naps, and who was comfortable in his own skin. While it sounds easy to get a profile up online, I was not your slapdash kind of person who'd rush something up there just to have it listed. Like everything else I did, I preferred to post a handcrafted, from-scratch portrait of myself. Fortunately, another friend of mine had begun coaching women over 40 in the dating arena. I hired her to write my profile and consult with me about how to answer the questions. She interviewed me at length and wrote a touching, comprehensive, and real narrative that included humor and irony. The fact that I loved NPR and Howard Stern would make sense to the right guy. Cast a wide net, she advised. Don't make specific income, education, or height a requirement. You might miss a great guy out there who has everything else you want. There are plenty of intellectuals and Renaissance men who don't have a string of initials after their name. I trusted her and forged ahead. I opted for the handle Campo Walker, referencing Campo Beach in Westport, the most soothing place I knew. I was hoping to attract someone for whom that rang a bell, as I did a three-mile circuit there several times a week and would love to share that with a man. It's a cliche to say that you like walks at the beach, but I thought my name choice was better than that of another woman who advertised herself as Weston Wench. She had to shoo guys away with that alias. Admittedly, she was younger and prettier, but I hardly concealed a not-so-tacit agreement that would benefit the men who contacted her. I hired someone to take photos that conveyed that although in my 60s, I looked younger than my years and had a shapely body. More than one potential match asked how recent my photos were. My first date was with a man named Michael, a psychiatrist from New Haven. We met at a Starbucks in Westport. He was in his early 70s, handsome, tall, and Jewish. I couldn't help thinking, this is what Mom always wanted, though I couldn't complete the sentence speculating about whether she would have wanted him for me or for herself. He and I talked comfortably standing at the counter as I ordered a tall decaf with cold soy milk. I'll have the same, he told the woman in the green apron, offering her a $10 bill. I liked his ease and command of the situation. I began comparing him with Ben in my mind. My ex would have been visibly nervous and might have asked, are you sure they have soy milk? Not wanting to create embarrassment for me or by association. Throughout my dating life and still, I subconsciously made those comparisons. After an hour of flowing conversation at a table in the middle of that coffee emporium, Michael asked me if I'd like to have dinner on Saturday night. As with the first experience I had selling my art in 1973, I thought I had this dating thing all figured out. That very first contact and date with Michael was going to be it. I'd found my next mate. What's the fuss been about? I go online for a few weeks, meet an attractive guy, bingo, why all the complaining? I mentally flipped my hair with the fingers of my right hand and raised my chin triumphantly. Not so fast. That weekend, our dinner at my favorite vegetarian restaurant got off to a rough start. I'm usually accurate about appointments and write down dates quickly and precisely, but there was a communications glitch somewhere between our establishing our next get-together while at Starbucks and my arrival that night. As I was driving to Bridgeport, my cell phone rang at 6:35 p.m. with an irritated Michael on the other end. For date number two, this was inauspicious. I thought we said 6:30, he grumbled. I thought you said you were going to be 15 minutes late because of your son's event. So I was aiming for 6:45. I'm not far away, I calculated. He stood to greet me when I arrived and kissed me on the cheek. He'd chosen a table behind the main desk where we would place our orders. The restaurant I'd selected, Bloodroot, was self-serve, owned and run by a lesbian cooperative, and offered the most delicious, healthy food in the area. Michael escorted me up to the front of the restaurant, where we studied the chalkboard menu that night, talked to Selma, a co-founder, and decided what to eat. I felt a little funny being there on a date because I'd been a regular patron there for ages, most recently with Ben, though not in the past year since our separation. I had called Selma after making the date with Michael to let her know that I was getting divorced and would be arriving with another man. Mature as I thought I was, I still cared what others might think. I wanted to ward off any misconceptions before they might be uttered. It was important that anyone I date like this food because what I ate was important to me. If I was going to have only 3 meals a day and nothing in between, I didn't want to waste even one. Clearly, Michael appreciated having been introduced to Bloodroot, another plus in his column. But during dinner, he completely dominated the conversation. For nearly 2 hours, he held court. I had the opportunity to learn a lot about his 2 marriages, 6 children, and extracurricular activities, biking and rowing, enough to know that he wasn't a match for me. I wanted a two-way exchange and a man who was sensitive enough to notice if it wasn't. Even though I knew it was happening, I was still not the kind of person who could easily fit into the discourse, "It's my turn, please." I spent decades in the role of audience with Ben. If on our second date my suitor, and a professional listener no less, didn't notice how one side of the night was, I wouldn't be the one to educate him. "This was great," he said as we were getting up to leave. "Would you like to go for a walk?" "No, thanks," I responded. "I'm ready to go home." So much for beginner's luck. If I had been 16 or 22 and had all the time in the world, I might have given it another try. But in my 7th decade, time was of the essence. The most important 4-letter word I learned in dating was next.
And sometimes it's the word you hear rather than the word you're saying. How do you handle that?
What do you mean?
Meaning that the guys, like,
when they reject you?
Yeah, when they reject you.
Well, you know, I have really good self-talk now. You know, his loss, he doesn't, you know, he hasn't looked into how amazing I am. I'm not, if based on, you know, whatever information he has, if that's what he's basing it on, then it wasn't meant to be.
Yeah. Now, Jane, you write a lot about recovery.
Yes. Yeah.
You want to tell us a little bit about how that fits in your life?
Yes. You know, one of the things about 12-step recovery is that, you know, any anonymous programs is that you don't mention the particular ones that you're in, but you can say that you're in recovery, you know, because they don't want to attach, you know, any person with a particular branch of the anonymous association. So I'll just say that I'm in several, you know, I've been in several of them. And what happened was that for the first time you went, and the format is pretty much the same wherever you go, is that there's an opening. And then every time somebody shares, you say, "Hi, I'm Jane." And you can define yourself, you know, with whatever, you know, however you want to define yourself. And everybody in the room says, "Hi, Jane." And then you have, you know, a few minutes to share. And after you've shared, everyone says, "Thank you, Jane." Now, I have to tell you, in my entire life, up until I started age 41, I had never had that experience of being so listened to and then acknowledged for having spoken. In my family of 4 kids, you just, you know, nothing was ever acknowledged. You spoke over each other and, you know, nobody ever said, you know, "Thank you for that. You know, would somebody else like to share?" It was just, you know, constant a barrage of talk. So that was very important to me. And one of the early things I say in the book is how I had to have therapy for the therapist to say, you know, "Can you ask Ben if you can finish your sentences?" I mean, that's how deep it was. And I said to him, you know, "Would you let me finish my sentence?" He goes, "Oh, I'm going to have to be so careful about what I say now." And, you know, he went on and on, but he did let me finish my sentences. But that was what I was used to, you know, being talked over, having my sentences completed for me. So this was head turning to me to say what I, you know, to think about what I wanted to say. And, you know, as a kid, I would, you know, I would pre-arrange everything I was going to say and then blurt it out. And I still do that. But what happens now is people will come up to me after a 12-step meeting and say, "I really identified with what you shared." And, you know, I'm thinking to myself, you heard that? You know, of course I heard it. The room was silent except for me speaking. But it was such a new experience for me to be acknowledged. And, you know, for anybody who hasn't been acknowledged, if that's how you grew up and your parents were always acknowledging you, God bless, you're so lucky. But in my family, it never happened. And so it was life-altering for me, and I couldn't get enough of it. But interestingly, I would go on Wednesday nights, I think it was 5:30, and my husband, Ben, would come home, and he'd take, you know, he'd watch the kids. They were still maybe like 7 to 14 or something years old. So I wasn't abandoning them, but, you know, I could leave the house for a couple hours. And the next meeting wasn't until the next Wednesday. It was a women's recovery meeting. And I said to one of the women, she said, you know, I go every day. I said, oh, I wish I could. And she said, God only gives you what you can handle. And I thought, well, that was very wise, because, you know, I needed a week to digest it. And then I would go again. And then I would go again. And one of the metaphors they use is that it's like peeling an onion. You know, I take off that layer and, ooh, there's another layer to look at. Take off that layer, another layer to look at. So, you know, I talk about a relationship program and then also a food program, because I used to cover up all my feelings with mint chocolate chip ice cream. That was it. You know, it was just like, I don't have to experience pain because I don't know if you have Friendly's where you are, but, you know, Friendly's was my favorite, you know, pre-Häagen-Dazs, my favorite flavor of ice cream. And if I was eating a bowl of ice cream, I didn't feel anything until the next day. And then I would feel terribly depressed because sugar is such a depressant. And if I didn't have more ice cream on the agenda, then I would start to feel these very bad feelings. And so eventually I decided this is really doing me more harm than good. And I let go of sugar 25 years ago completely. Unless it's like the third or fourth ingredient, you know, it's like, I don't eat candy. I don't eat cake, but you know, now I can have sorbet, because it's the third ingredient and I'm not addicted to it. And what happens when you put down your substance of choice, whether it's alcohol, sugar, gambling, sex, whatever it is, a lot of feelings come up. And what 12-step recovery offers is alternative tools to dealing with feelings. And mostly, I like the expression I've been hearing lately, is that the opposite of addiction is connection. And so by connecting with people, isn't that nice, on a soul level, fills me up in a way that I never got filled up as a child or even as a spouse. You know, I never felt seen and heard. And in the rooms of recovery, I do every time I take advantage of going, which I do very regularly.
And you don't realize what other people are going through until you reach out to them. And because everybody
is that we all suffer from the same things, you know, to a greater or lesser degree. And, you know, alcoholism, you know, which so many people are affected by, and drug addiction and opioid addiction, the significant person in their life becomes unavailable to them, and they're not seen, and we're not seen and reflected. It's very difficult to know who you are unless you've got a very, very strong sense of self, which I did not. I've over the years it has built. And somebody I heard today in a meeting, they said, let's not call it self-esteem, let's call it self-compassion. And the more compassion and love I have for myself, the more I can endure, the more I can face difficulties, because I know that I'm deeply cared for by myself and by my fellows.
Okay, you had some private therapy, right? So which do you think is better, or is there enough?
I think they're both really important. You know, I hear some things in therapy that, you know, I would never hear in the rooms. I'll just recently, I had a cold this week, and I had theater tickets Wednesday night, and I wasn't feeling well, and I had a therapy appointment. I said, I don't know what to do. You know, should I go to the show? It's $65. I hate to give up the ticket. And she said, you suffer from, she calls it a humiliation of needs. I was not allowed to have needs as a child. And so I feel humiliated when I get sick. Like, I shouldn't be sick. You know, that's that lost child thing. I shouldn't be sick. Isn't that interesting? So, you know, that is not going to come out in the rooms. I might hear somebody, you know, and then I shared it with people and they can say, oh, I have that too. But I needed a professional really to zero in on what I suffer from, and the anxiety that I suffer from, you know, not being seen as a child is traumatic, really traumatic. So, I said early in the book, an early counselor said to me, did you hear what you said? And I said, he said, you said I should have been happy. you know, I was describing my childhood. I had everything. You know, I had a, you know, education, a beautiful home, clothing, food on the table. I should have been happy. And I didn't realize when you say should, you know, that it actually wasn't, right? So,
right.
You know, he picked that up early. But, you know, somebody in the rooms isn't going to diagnose me or tell me. They can just identify with and with my experience and I with theirs. But to actually diagnose and help me symptomatically, I feel I need a professional. Some people don't, you know, and that's fine. But for me, it's been, you know, on and off for 30 years. You know, when I was going through the divorce, I had one. And then recently, in the last 2 years, I started therapy again. And it's been incredibly helpful and eye-opening.
Jane, let's talk a little bit more about your writing process. You mentioned that you started writing this in kind of vignettes. At what point did you decide, okay, we're going to make this a narrative and, you know, a book-length narrative? And how did you go about doing that?
I had to take lessons. I had, after this class with Ann Randolph, I hired her assistant, a wonderful woman named Kate. You know, I was writing these 3-page things, and she said, oh, this is gold. It's so wonderful. She said, can you try something longer form? And it's like, yeah, I don't want to, you know. And I really didn't know how to do that. And so I went to classes. I took a 10-week class at the Gotham Writers, and they were saying things. You know, I said to them, I think I should be in the advanced class. You know, I've written 2 books, and I was married to an English teacher for 38 years. You know, I think I've gotten this by osmosis. And I go into the advanced class, and they're talking about major dramatic questions and having conflict. And I thought, what's a major dramatic question? You know, I didn't know. And so I had to get educated. So I did take that class, and then I went back and started taking beginning, or, you know, memoir one, so that I understood that, you know, every character, every person in the book has to have a need and a conflict of what they want to achieve. And they have to be treated with regard, tremendous regard. You can't just be me whining about my upbringing. Nobody would be interested in that, and they'd hate me. So I had to show that my mother came from such, you know, such deprivation in her life. And her only response was, she was very filled up by us when we were little, but then when we started to have demands, she couldn't handle it. Not because she didn't want to, but because she absolutely was incapable of it. And that made us think, well, she's a terrible mother. But it was just that she was somebody who was so desperately needy. And that's where therapy comes in as well. You know, she was a sick puppy. So it made me far more compassionate, you know, for her. It didn't make me like her. She was very mean to me, very mean to me, very critical. I've just written a piece for Mother's Day. And when I got pregnant the first time, she said, you know, I'd love to buy you a wardrobe. And I thought, oh, that's so wonderful. And we get into the dressing room. She said, how much weight have you gained? Your breasts are enormous.
Oh, my.
Now, you know, you don't say that to a 25-year-old who, you know, has body shame anyhow and is, you know, it's a first pregnancy. What do I know? So I'm crying in the dressing room, and she's, you know, berating me. So she just, you know, she couldn't control herself. She didn't, you know, I think she would have wanted to, but she had no model. Her mother died when she was less than 2. So she didn't have somebody caring and loving taking care of her. So, you know, that's, and we all grow up with, you know, children of children, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we all do the best we can. And
we do.
You know, your mother did the best she could.
She did. And there are so many things I'm grateful for. You know, I have, she was an entrepreneur before there were entrepreneurs. You know, she had incredible drive, incredible creativity, and a passion for theater. And all of that I got. And it also, you know, it had me do, you know, if I'd had a loving, doting mother, we wouldn't be talking right now. You know,
that's true.
I'd be out in my garden or something like that.
That,
you know,
is
I
true.
Just would be, I would have had a very different life. So I'm grateful, you know, I'm grateful.
So at what point did you decide this was a book?
You know, I'm such an optimist. I thought it was a book when I was writing the 3-page vignette.
Oh, okay.
But then it took 5 years of, you know, writing and submitting 25 pages for workshops in the, you know, in my classes, and then going off. I went to the Iowa Writers Festival. I took myself on my own 2-week writing retreat. I hired writing coaches, a developmental editor. I had a dramaturg work on it. You know, it's just a tremendous amount of work to put together a book. So much respect for good writers, so much respect, and wonderful what you're doing to, you know, help people talk about their craft.
Oh, thank you.
So, you know, yeah, I, you know, I've just learned so much along the way, and I would definitely like to write more, but, you know, I've got to launch this baby, and then we'll see where it goes. But I have so much more to say.
So tell us about your publisher and how you connected.
Well, you know, that was synchronistic also. I went to the, there's something called the Festival of Writers in San Miguel de Allende in Mexico, and I'd heard about it, and I decided I would go. It was two Februaries ago, and it was the first day. It was in a hotel and, you know, outdoors, and I see this woman sitting there, and it's about an hour before it's going to start, and she has a computer. And I just sit down next to her randomly, and I said, oh, are you getting online? What's the password? And we start talking, and then I said, what are you working on? She said, well, I've written a book. I forget the name of it, but she said it was published by She Writes Press, which I had heard of, but not a lot. So over the few days we were together, I heard more and more about it, met other authors there who were also involved with She Writes Press. They had their books with them, and they were beautiful. And then it turned out that a coach I had worked with, just a business coach I had worked with years ago, was her editor was Brooke Warner, who is the founder of She Writes Press. And I thought, oh, when things start to come together like that, it was like, you know, when I stopped egg decorating, you know, because of Martha Stewart, you know, when I hear Brooke Warner, She Writes Press, the woman says, you know, the first person I meet. And so I submitted, you have to apply to be accepted by them. And I was one of 40 authors for 2019. And I cannot say enough, it's a hybrid model. So it's, I pay for the print run, I paid for copy editing, but they, you know, I did my own developmental edit. And then the share of profits is much more equitable, which it's not in a traditional publishing world. And I have much more control over it. They did the cover, which I love, and they chose the title, which I also love. You know, more will be revealed. But they hosted a conference for, we had 62 women authors there in November. I don't know another publishing house that provides that, where we were networking. We had Jessamine Ward come and talk, give a keynote and a workshop. And then there were people from BookBuzz and, you know, several, I'm trying to think, writers, publishing, what is it, PW, Publishers Weekly, mm-hmm. You know, come and talk to us, really inform us about the state of the industry. And it was so informative. We were there, I think it was three nights. It was just wonderful. And so it's a very, they're a very special group, and they're growing tremendously. And I'm just very glad to have gotten, I think they're 6 years old, and I'm glad to have gotten in early. I've met wonderful women, and we have our own website, our own Facebook page where we support each other. It's all quite good.
You know, it does seem like there's a number of new publishing companies that are coming up and really doing some great work. And like you said, some of them are like a hybrid model. Some of them are more along the traditional line where they do a lot of the work. But I've noticed that it's not just you know, I mean, we certainly interview authors from Penguin and Macmillan and, you know, the mainline companies, and that's still a great way to go. But there really seems to be some energy, some new energy in publishing now.
Well, they say, I like the use of the word, they say she's disrupting the industry. Brooke is disrupting the industry, and she's, you know, a sought after speaker on that subject, and she's doing a really good job, and her deadlines are, you know, very closely adhered to. So I already have, you know, my copies, I have 100 copies right here. You know, I don't have to worry, I'll be speaking all over the country, and I don't have to worry, will the books be shipped? You know, they're already there. So, you know, they're very responsible, and you know, I think shaking up the industry in their, you know, their adherence to deadlines in a very nice way.
Well, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Jane. We are
my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Completely out of time.
Oh, can't be out of time.
Mom, do you have some final words of wisdom?
Well, yeah, she had this in her book, and I think she said that she repeats it and often, the Serenity Prayer. To accept the things I cannot change, to possess the courage to change the things I can, and to have the wisdom to know the difference.
Amen.
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 Yeah. Thank you. That's a great note to go close on.
Thanks, Jane. And see you all next week on Writer's Voices.
Thank you, bye, Monica, everybody. And Caroline. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.